Following interview was conducted on behalf of the Oral History Program of Essentia High School. The interview is Jerry Taylor. The interviewer is Ashley Real and Tita Tan. The interview took place at Essentia High School on May 26th at 8:30 a.m. Okay, so how long have you been working in the district?
It'll be 19 years in September.
Wow. And what brought you to the first position?
I have been, my background is in family counseling, and I had done family counseling for 13 years. And I had been offered a couple of times an opportunity to work in the schools as Carol Schauberger's position. And I turned it down, and on the third time, I decided not to turn it down. And so I didn't really think I'd like working in the schools. And after that first year, I loved it. And then I got offered a full-time job.
So have you been working in like middle school, high school, or just like strictly high school?
Since 1986, I've been working just in high schools. Prior to that, I did groups in the middle school. I did a group at Brown and at Pointer for kids who were having trouble behaviorally in school as well as drug and alcohol issues.
How do you think drug and alcohol issues have changed over the years?
Oh, that's a great question. and actually, this is the question I've been thinking a lot about. It's something that I've been concerned about. When I came to the district in 86, there was a strong parent and community involvement in the issue around drugs and alcohol. It was the primary concern of parents, and it was on the kind of a priority of the district to address the drug problem in the schools. And we developed quite a few really interesting programs for students. Natural helper movement began then. We also had what we call the student action group, which were kids who actually were in clubs designed to work on dealing with the drug and problem in the school and alcohol problem. So we did a lot of preventative things. And we put on assemblies and had speakers into the schools. It was quite an involvement by students. We had probably about 60 students in the club at the time. In addition to that, we had groups for kids in the school. We had a class that I ran for both first and second period. At one time, they had 30 students in my classes that were kids who had been identified with drug and alcohol problems and had been in treatment and had come back to school. And this class was a support for them, a person they could check in with, that it was me. And I would be an advocate for them in their transition back to school, because kids without drug and alcohol problems, when they try to become clean, they run into all sorts of problems, not only with dealing with feelings they haven't dealt with previously, but they just have problems with school around the transition of just dealing with focusing issues, kind of being agitated a lot, and having someone to support them and to talk to teachers about giving them a break and giving them additional time to turn things in and so forth was helpful. Well, we don't have any of that here. We do have natural helpers. But the shift over the years has really changed. For some reason, about 93 or so, the drug problem, we would do an annual survey, and what we noticed is there was a big drop-off in the number of kids who were doing counseling at the school, which was great. That's what we were working for. But what happened was that the programs were away as well. I hope I can make this clear. This is another thing that has changed that isn't related to the schools is how treatment is delivered to the communities. In the late 80s, the big programs in early 90s, it was trying to get kids into drug treatment was a priority for a lot of the, there were big inpatient programs that were trying to get patients into their program. So they ran, and those programs would got third-party payments through insurance. Well, as insurance payments became more expensive to do inpatient, the insurance people started to back out of those programs in favor of outpatient programs. And it changed how we identified problems in the school, because now they weren't asking us to do interventions in the school to identify kids to get into treatment like they had previously, because the treatment programs weren't there.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's just an example of the shift in money changed and how the industry, the insurance industry, affected the treatment industry that then changed how we worked with kids in the school.
Mm-hmm.
And so today, I don't see us working with kids where we identify drugs as the primary problem like we did in the early 90s. And when kids had problems, we would really work hard to identify what is the problem. And if drug and alcohol was the primary problem, we wanted to deal with that first, and then the secondary issues we would deal with later. I don't see us working that way any longer. I feel like we've moved back into more of a punitive model, where kids are just told they can't come back to school, or they're suspended for a period of time, and then the second offense, then they need to be expelled. And I just don't believe in the punitive model, especially around the drug and alcohol issue. I see it as a problem that needs to be addressed through treatment and getting help to it. Now, obviously, if the person repeats and continues to have problems, then yeah, you can't have them in the environment if they continue to repeat and be self-destructive. But yeah, I think it's just important to use those opportunities in a way. When a kid gets caught with drugs and alcohol here in the school, I see it as an opportunity in a way. It's an opportunity that we now know what they're doing, and we can help them and to address that problem and get them to the program that they need to, the program that will help them. I just don't think we take advantage of that opportunity. When I did family therapy, we used to work with, I'd work with parents to create a crisis so that the student would be more motivated to do something about the problem. I mean, you know, people are just that way. Unless the motivation often comes when you're uncomfortable and you realize that, you know, I got to do something. But if no one's really giving you a problem with it, then you think there is no problem, and therefore you don't need to do anything differently. And with drugs and alcohol, you need to make it really clear that this is a problem, and people around you see it as a problem, and that you need to address that. And that's been a change. And I've been uncomfortable with it. I wish that we had programs here in the school that would, when a student is caught with drugs and alcohol, that they would go through a 5 or 6 week group here that would be informational as well as well as an opportunity for us to just assess the problem. The problem with doing assessments with kids in the school and just having one session is that most people lie.
You know,
this was my first time, or I've tried it, this is the second time I've tried it, or I only had one beer. I've heard those stories so many times throughout the years, but when you get to know the person and you start having, you've had more opportunity to talk with them and to give them information, sometimes they'll open up a little more and give you more of what's going on, that then there's more trust there, and then hopefully you can get them into some help so that they can work on that problem. So I just feel like we lose on an opportunity when a student gets suspended for drugs and alcohol, that we haven't offered them more than what we've offered them.
Yeah.
And back in the 80s and early 90s, we were able to do that.
How do you feel about parent involvement? Do you feel like they've been in decline and they don't care as much, or they just let it go by, or do you feel like they're really acting upon the problem?
The parent issues are hard ones. I do think that there has been a shift in parent involvement. But I'm very empathic about it with parents. Kind of what's happened in the last 20 years and has been, I think, and actually started prior to that, but with so many more parents having to, both mom and dad having to work to just support the family, it's difficult, it's more difficult for them to be the kind of support they want to be to their children. And I have noticed over the years that there are more students who are trying to raise themselves. That there's, and I'm not saying that there isn't a caring parent or a parent that really wants to give the best to the child. It's more structural, that economic structure that has occurred that doesn't allow the parent to provide the kind of emotional support or just being there. You know, and having raised two kids myself, I know sometimes just being there and not necessarily doing something is as important as it's important to the child. They just want the parent there. And teenagers are kind of like, I want you when I want you, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and so not having that, I just see a lot of students who go home and who then don't have the supervision and are pretty much free to do what they want to do and make poor choices, and they don't have an adult to help them bounce off those choices or have the trust that they need an adult to talk about those choices. And I just see more kids kind of drifting. And that's, I think, a problem. And it probably relates to the crime. I'm not really so much in touch with what all the crime trends are in the schools. I do see that kids leave school and are just floating out there, and I just hate that. I just feel like we should be offering them something, and it really bothers me when we part, we don't have the funding and we can't have more diverse programs to reach those kids. Because education is, to me, the key that can make the difference between poverty and success.
Mm-hmm.
And,
with all the kids increasing, do you think gains are?
Well, from what I understand, yeah. You know, when we first opened Century, it was the eye opener for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if my eyes were closed or hit high, but when Century opened, that first year, the 97-98, was really a difficult year here. I don't know if anyone's ever mentioned that to you, but we had a situation where we had almost 1,500 kids. About 1,100 to 1,200 of them were 9th and 10th graders. We had a very small junior class and we had no seniors. And so we had all these kids who'd never been in high school before. Plus, there was this sort of territorial thing and the gang exposure and the amount of gang activity that occurred right away really was shocking. I mean, it just caught me by surprise. And this is the first year that I can compare what I've seen happen this year to the first year we opened. I feel like there's a lot of gang activity. It's more exposed and it's more noticeable than it has been for the years in between. And I don't know what that's about. But maybe it, you know, we had a gang guy come out and talk to the staff and sometimes just hearing about it and learning about it, you get more attuned and you're more aware of it. And it may be just that. Maybe it was just out of ignorance in the past, it was not really paying attention. But I see the two comparisons from the first year and this current year.
And how are they being dealt with?
Well, you know, I don't get to deal with those situations.
Mm-hmm.
They're usually when the activity is when something happens that clearly is a gang related thing. There's suspension and expulsions that occur. And I know we had some expulsions this year around gang activity. And it really, I had some of my students on my case that were expelled and left because of a fight that occurred here. And that really bothers me that we can't have students on. That's what I'm being told. That's kind of scary. You know, in the years that I've lived in Hillsboro, when I first moved here, you know, I could drive. This is from my house, which is in the middle of Hillsboro, kind of near downtown Hillsboro, to Portland without ever hitting a stoplight. And I can't get three blocks from my house now. And it's, I say that because the city has become just so much more complex, both in traffic and people, but just in the makeup of the city. I mean, we're all aware of that 10th Street area where there's a lot of shops that are restaurants that are Hispanic, Mexican restaurants and so forth, a lot of businesses that are related to that. And see, I don't have a problem with that. I've gone into, I go to Mexico every year, and I go into restaurants in Mexico, and there's always someone who can speak English.
Right.
I went to a restaurant in Hillsboro, and there was no one in there that could speak English. And I had to, it was lucky that Anna Calderon, who's a staff member here of the LRC, was in the restaurant at the time, and she saw me and came up and helped me order. because I wasn't going to be able to support her. We couldn't communicate. And that said something to me, how this is truly a bilingual community. And it's easy for us to kind of say, you know, to think that otherwise, or to just, there might be a large Hispanic community that, you know, still is close, but it's changed a lot. It's much more diverse. Where are we in the question?
Oh, I don't even know.
Well, probably from my perspective of where I live and what I see in town and the people I'm around, I'm aware, much more aware of the Hispanic community. And you know, if I lived more in this area, I might be more aware of the Asian community. But this last year, with a couple of incidents that occurred, I realized there's more Asian gang activity. But most of the gang activity that I've been aware of and I've seen and kind of confronting, and have, you know, I see all of the gangs riding. Is around the standard.
Do you see a trend in the type of kids that come to your province?
Well, you know, I have more depressed kids all the time, more kids that are depressed. That are more diagnosed with depression than ever before. And that's something I've noticed over the years, that we just are. The medical community is much more willing to label teenagers than they were 20 years ago. Before, they were really careful about giving a diagnosis to a teenager. They seem to be willing to do it these days and do it quite often now. And they've had obsessive compulsive, where in the last few years I've had probably 3 to 4 of those kinds of diagnoses. A lot of anxiety disorder diagnosis, that's something that's really into kids who are extremely anxious. You know, I sometimes wonder, this is just a Jerry Taylor wonder, but you know, when you watch these drug commercials on TV, and they're suddenly advertising anxiety drugs and all these depressants, it seems to also come with an increased number of diagnoses in those areas. And that bothers me. It's like, are the drugs created to, and this is just a question, are the drugs created to deal with the problem? Or are the problems, or do we take kind of some normal adolescent angst and treat them in this with new definition? I just wonder about that. I don't like labeling, and I don't like doing it at a really young age, especially when students are moving through all the things that we ask them to move through. And this society's got so much more complex than what we ask of people, and the pressures around consumer consumerism and who's, and what you're supposed to look like and all of that. And we're all supposed to smell good and look good and be good, and, you know. And it's just hard. And then I think, you know, I see kids struggling with these issues. I just don't think a label is helpful for them. I think what they need is guidance and compassion and support. But a lot of people, ADHD was another thing that was happening in the last 2 years. Diagnosis. When parents can't control their wild little voice, they call them ADHD and they unmedicate it. And 95% of the ADHD kids in the world are Americans. What is that about? Mm-hmm. Why are they just Americans? Why aren't they Germans or French or Chinese? Or, I mean, why are they Americans? What is it about us that we have to have ADHD kids? Mm-hmm. I mean, so when parents say that, tell me that their student isn't on medication and they really wish to get them on medication, or the student would get medication, I try to reframe that to them and say there's other ways to try to help your son or daughter with that. Diet can be a thing, having a good diet. I mean, I think that's something that's really a problem with our society, is we don't eat well. So, kids go through the McDonald's lines. A lot of families do it, and KFC, and you know, the quick stops, you know. And you just, if there's a way to, there's literature out there on ADHD about trying to control it through a diet. But you have to, you know, it's harder to do that than it is to give a pill. Yeah. As much as you can take this and be good.
Yeah.
You know. So I have been concerned with the trends around the labeling of kids in those areas. We just have a lot of kids who now are on what we call a 504, which is a program for students who have disabilities, and the disabilities list gets longer and longer every year. So anxiety disorder, depression, ADHD, all of those are now a disability that we need to address in the school. And no, I just appreciate the opportunity to do this. It has really been useful for me to think about these things again. Especially the drug and alcohol, has brought back with me, has helped me kind of redefine that maybe some of us need to talk again about programs and what we need to do. And helping our students.
Thank you.